You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm director of the RSA's Action and Research Centre, and it's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's special event examining what it takes to make cities and their communities thrive. Tonight's lecture is part of the RSA Bossom series with a focus on the built environment and society. The series was endowed by Lord Alfred Bossom, architect and politician in 1965. This evening we'd like to remember the life of Lord Alfred's son, Sir Clive Bossom, MP. Sir Clive was a lover of the arts, a long-standing public servant, and proud of Britain's relationship with Europe and the Commonwealth, amongst many, many other things besides. He was a life fellow here at the RSA and an enthusiastic advocate for our work. I'm pleased to welcome members of the Bossom family attending this evening and offer kind thanks on behalf of the RSA for their valuable support. It's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker, Jonathan F.P. Rose. Jonathan is a leading authority on urban development and renewal. He has progressed award-winning projects, investment funds and city plans to model solutions to issues of housing, economic development and the environment. I should say I first met Jonathan in a lodge on top of a mountain in Austria. But that's another story. It seemed like a good idea to invite him to the RSA, so here we are this evening. In his lecture this evening, Jonathan will explain how we can design and reshape cities with the goal of equalising their landscape of opportunity. In an increasingly urbanised world, how can we integrate social, economic and environmental solutions to enhance equality, resilience, adaptability and well-being? These themes chime with the RSA's work, where we look at how citizens can engage, participate and co-create a better, more inclusive form of growth for their cities, towns and regions. We're delighted to have Jonathan with us this evening. I'll be joining Jonathan later on stage and we're looking forward to hearing your questions. But without further ado, let me hand over to Jonathan Rose.
So thank you so much for having me here. I'm honored to be here at the RSA. There are things that are affecting cities that we call global megatrends, and these are affecting every city in the world. In fact, they're affecting all of us, and so for us to decide any strategy that we need to make moving forward, we need to understand them. The first is the world is very rapidly urbanizing. By 2080, supposedly 80% of the world's population will live in cities, and partly that's also because of rural issues, but that'll be another talk. The world's population is growing and is projected to stabilize at about 10 billion people by 2050. And the problem is this very rapid growth and urbanization combination is one for which we have insufficient vision, we don't have plans for it, and we are unable to keep up with the infrastructure necessary for it, particularly in the developing world where the urbanization is happening most rapidly. So, for example, people who live in Mexico City drive 3.5 hours or commute 3.5 hours every day in each direction, on average, to get to work. The world is also becoming much more prosperous. Although we project about 2 billion people remaining in poverty, as the world becomes more middle class, it consumes more. This is very bad for the environment, obviously. And we actually, the rate of consumption is out of balance with the rate of the Earth's regenerative capacity. So there's another crash that's coming from that. Speaking of crashes, there's also climate change. We're dramatically changing our climate. This happens to be from Beijing. And that's also unsustainable. What I love about this picture is that's actually, if anybody's been in Beijing recently, that's actually what the air quality looks like on a typical day. One effect of climate change is that water patterns are changing. There's too much rain in some areas, and there's increased desert in other areas. And by the way, as the sea level rises, that's also going to make more salty our groundwater. And so there's going to be a whole... We've already seen water issues. There are going to be increasing water issues. We live in an age of enormous volatility, and that is increasing. The United States military in the 1990s created a phrase called VUCA, which stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And the interaction of these things mean that things are much more, we live in a much less stable and predictable world. There's also the issue of income inequality. For a variety of economic reasons, the world is becoming more and more unequal. As a consequence of this, we're seeing much more political instability. There's something called the Gini Index. The Gini Index is structured so that a number of one, it means one person has all the wealth in the world and nobody else has any. An index of zero means that everybody shares wealth equally. And the United States, by the way, is at 39 right now, 0.39. And the UN says when you hit 4, 0.4, you hit instability, social instability. And this is London in 2011 when there were riots here in the summer. This Google map shows the deeper the red, the deeper the poverty. And what you see is the riots, which are noted by the little points, didn't take place at the poorest areas. They actually took place where there was an invisible line where the second generation immigrants felt they could not move from lower middle class to middle class. These lines exist all throughout our societies in both the developed and the developing world. And they are a serious and negative fault line. These are the counties of the United States, and this is a measure of opportunity. Anthony mentioned earlier that one of my goals is that we equalize the landscape of opportunity, and it's quite unequal. So the deeper the red, so this measures if you are a bottom quartile family, poorest quartile family, and what is the likelihood that a child at the age of 26 will do better than their parents? The deeper the red, the more likely they will do worse. In fact, the deeper the red, those are areas in which a poor child would do worse than their poor parents. In the 1950s, 76% of bottom quartile children ended up having higher income than their parents by the time they were 26. Today, it's only 32%, less than half. So we are going negative. The landscape of opportunity is unequal, and one of my goals is to tell you what it takes to equalize it. And then there's one more megatrend, which is that work is dramatically changing. This is an automobile factory. And if you look to the upper left, there's one human being in this entire photo. So the nature of work is changing. We're actually going to be eliminating a huge amount of work. And one of the questions that we need to ask, which we have not been sufficiently asking, so let's talk about a guaranteed income, a minimum income, and all that. But the real question is, what is the purpose of humanity? And what should we do with those people? You know, what should be the goal that we set? And I actually believe that the goal that we need to set is that we need to do two things. We need to equalize the landscape of opportunity. We need to rebalance humans and nature. And there's a huge amount of work that the current economic system doesn't pay for. And if the economic system could actually unleash all those people who look at the grim prospect today of being out of work and in the future of being out of work, and instead we said there was a higher purpose for you, we could actually maybe achieve some of the things that I want to talk about. Beirut. This is outside of Beirut, actually. And this is what happens when civilizations collapse. And it's a terrible thing. So when you have this combination, this is not the first time we've had population climate change over resource consumption, income inequality. And when those have happened throughout history, what we have seen is if there's extreme income inequality, and if people feel that the culture is not just, that the civilization does not recognize all of us, then we have revolution. And when there is the same conditions, but people feel the civilization is a just one, then it just kind of peters out. So, for example, in 1100, there was an enormous climate-caused drought, and the Mayan civilization collapsed. And it collapsed in flames because it was an exploitive economy in which the people felt was not just. At the same time, the largest city in the world was Angkor Wat. And Angkor Wat was a water-based civilization, and it too went through climate change. And it just petered down over the next 300 years. It just dispersed. The population slowly reduced, etc. Because it was a Buddhist culture. It was a very different, it was a Buddhist Hindu culture, but it was a very different culture. And so the way in which we deal with these coming issues, I think, is going to be critical in the 21st century. This is Tepe Göbekli Tepe, which is the world's oldest building. It's the very first building that we've ever discovered, and it was built before we even had huts. And it was It's in the Turkish mountains and the southern mountains, and it's the world's first temple. And the reason temples arose, and they arose in what were perceived to be sacred spots, was their purpose was to be the acupuncture point that balanced humans and nature. This is way before we had hierarchical civilization, and yet hundreds and hundreds of people gathered together to lift stones much greater than Stonehenge, to carve them in fantastic beasts that were images of people that were half human and half beast. So again, that integration of humans and nature. And it was a place that celebrated the birth of agriculture. Except agriculture wasn't born for another 2,000 years. These people actually had a vision in which they perceived that the next step of civilization was agriculture, and they were celebrating this human nature advance long before it happened. And interestingly, when the ethnobotanists who look at the DNA of today's seeds, the barley and the emmer wheats, etc., that were the foundation seeds of agriculture, they trace them back to 20 miles from this spot. So I actually believe they were at this spot, because these guys knew before our scientists knew. But at any rate, we see the archaeologist Klaus Schultz says, first came the temple, then came the city. At the root of every city in ancient times, throughout the continents, was a temple. So I believe that actually one of the foundations of civilization, the foundations of urbanization, is this desire to harmonize humans and nature. It is something that is missing from our cities, and it's something that we need to bring back. Another thing was trade, and trade is a vast interconnectivity. This is a map of Mesopotamia. What was interesting is trade comes from differentiation. Dan Siegel, who's a psychologist, says that the healthy mind integrates differentiated parts. The healthy civilization integrates differentiated parts. You need differentiation. So what's interesting about the birth of agriculture is they were growing fig trees in one area and olive trees in another area and goats in another area and sheep in another area and so on. And then they began to get more industrial. So gold and silver and lapis and copper and shells, all of these things were being traded. The archaeologists call this an interaction zone. And civilization and cities arose not as individual entities, but as interdependent phenomena that grew out of this whole interconnected area. This is Hammurabi, and Hammurabi was one of the first great leaders of Babylonia. In 1752 BC, he created a code for his people. And he says in it that the purpose is so that a good shadow is spread over the city, so that people will repose in peace, that the strong may not injure the weak. In order to protect widows and orphans, to bespeak justice in the land, to settle disputes, to heal all injuries, to further the well-being of mankind. This was a foundational purpose of civilization. And is not one, and it was very clear. He wanted to make this clear, so he carved this on stones and placed the stones throughout his land. So this is a second principle. I said that balancing humans and nature was the first one. This is another one that I believe, and doesn't this language sound biblical, but it doesn't sound current. This is not the language that we hear when we watch one of Rupert Murdoch's publication, read one of his publications, or read his watch one of his television stations. This is not something that is current in our civilization, and I actually believe that is a precondition for us to be able to solve the issues that I described earlier. We actually need to imagine creating a civilization in which the strong will not injure the weak, to protect the widows and orphans, to bespeak justice throughout the land. So as I began to try and figure out how do I integrate all of this, particularly when I was writing a book, I felt like I needed a metaphor of vast integration. Because in fact, to me, what was clear is we solve problems too much as silos. And I'll give you an example. I've been speaking a lot to urban designers recently, and the practice of urban design is a physical one. But in fact, a physical plan is insufficient to solve these issues. We also have to have an education plan and a health plan and a well-being plan and an open space. These things all have to be tied together, the future of work. And too often, our architects and urban planners aren't being trained in all of that. So I felt like I needed an analogy for a vast integration. And I love music. And so I drew on Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. This is his hand, and look how beautiful it is. Essentially, music before the 1700s, musical scales were tuned perfectly, but in ways that you couldn't go from scale to scale. Temperament was an averaging system that kind of equalized all the different scales, and it unleashed for Bach 24 major and minor keys on the keyboard. And all of a sudden, his purpose, which was to imagine the magnificence of the universe, this extraordinary whole that he perceived, and he was a deeply religious man, his goal was to manifest it on earth in music. And he needed this capability of integrating all these major and minor keys to be able to express something as large as he wished to do. So that idea of temperament, and temperament used for, so it's integration, but it's not just technical integration, it's integration used for a beautiful and higher purpose. I chose as my theme, and that became the organizing principle of the book. The other organizing principle actually comes from ecology, because life is amazing. Life, and we see that vast integration, we see coevolution, we see how all these pieces work together in life and in nature. And so I, in the book and in my thinking, I continually look back and say, how does ecology function? So I'm going to take this quote apart a little bit for you. So what is fitness? So when Darwin said in his fifth edition of The Origin of the Species that we grow by survival, evolution proceeds by survival of the fittest, he didn't just mean the fittest like I'm the most muscular and I can beat you up. He meant that which fits the most together. And if you think about ecology, it is this magnificent fitness. We have created a civilization in an urban pattern today, which I would call an unfit fitness. It works because all the pieces that are together, for example, of our economy, but they are unfit in that they are not generating the goals of Hammurabi, in which the strong are protecting the weak and in which the well-being of all is being cared for. And so people are unfitted in a way. There's a disjointedness, there's an uncomfortableness. That people feel like things are going too fast. They have not found their place in it, where there's a malaise and unhappiness. I mean, individually, a lot of us are thriving, but as a general civilization, we currently have an unfit fitness. And so one of my questions is, how do we take cities, where 80% of the world's population is going to be living, and if we can make those places of great human and nature fitness, then we've solved a lot of the problem. So I have a methodology for doing this, and as an urban planner, and it begins with having a vision, and that vision turned into a plan, and then community health indicators. We need to use the tools of government, which are regulation investment, such as building and zoning codes, investment, which are things such as investment in infrastructure, incentives such as tax breaks, and leadership. And we need to put those together and continually compare the outcomes and evolve, create an evolving system. So this happens to be a vision. Now, interestingly, visions very rarely come from city leadership and almost never from city planning departments, who today are much too busy regulating and kind of managing processes. Very often we see them coming from independent groups. The greatest city plan in the United States 20th century was done, the Burnham Plan of Chicago was engaged by a group of businessmen. This comes from the Portland Sustainability Institute, and it's about their vision for the future of Portland. It was done in 2003, so 13 years ago. They said, we want to be denser because we have an urban growth boundary. We're going to grow, but we want to protect the open space outside of that. And so for the Portland, that's a denser building in the center. You see solar and wind on it because they said we want it to be greener. In the street, you see light rail, a green car, a bus, bicycles, and people walking. They said we want multiple means of transit. On the left, you see a park. On the right, there's a woman selling what says Oregon Grown Food because that urban growth boundary, they wanted to have thriving farms outside it. And you see a happy child because they said, we want this to be a place where families can thrive. There's 100 pages behind all this, but there's an image, there's a sense of what their vision was. So I believe that first, if we're going to solve the issues I described, we need a vision for what is the thriving city of the 21st century. In 2050, what do we want London to be? What do we want New York to be? And if we can build consensus about that, then we have an idea of where we are going, and we can begin to move there. The second thing is we can measure our progress now with big data. There's an enormous amount of information. This is the Santa Monica Sustainability Index, and I'll just read you some of the points on it. But it says, so on the upper right, it says income disparity, traffic congestion, solid waste generation, energy use, greenhouse gas emission, traffic, vehicle miles traveled, parks and open space, voter participation in off-year elections, perception of safety, student suspension rates, student drug and alcohol abuse, students enrolled in advanced placement courses. You can measure, we don't have to debate whether my measure is better than yours. We can actually create a community-based process and a professional-based process and come up with hundreds or thousands of indicators of what the true well-being of a city is. And then as we unfold the city, as we build more and more, as we create new health institutions, as we resolve educational curriculums, we can be measuring. Are we really getting closer to our vision or not? And we can, this is what nature does. Nature is continually adjusting and co-evolving. We're too rigid in terms of setting long-term plans and then fixing towards them. This is then an architect named Peter Calthorpe created this scenario analysis process. You can take those plans, you can run them through scenarios and actually see what their projected outcomes are. And so we don't have to guess. We can begin. This is a guessing mechanism, an approximating mechanism. So we can begin to figure out how to evolve towards the kind of city we want. And then we have feedback from the real, for what's happening in real experience. And then as we know we have to adjust, we can actually test different hypothetical models and then build them in reality. The hypothetical models won't be perfect, but we can keep co-evolving. So that's a way of creating a dynamic, co-evolving plan to reach towards multiple goals. So very interesting. One of the things we need to do is to focus on what are called co-benefits, because we are in a resource-constrained society. Now, what's interesting is when you plant trees in streets, neighborhoods that have a lot of trees are 6 degrees cooler in the summer. That's a good solution for climate change. Trees, as they grow, absorb carbon. That's a good solution for climate change. They absorb pollution, and we now know that air pollution leads to Alzheimer's and many has bad for your health in general, but also is one of the drivers of neurodegenerative diseases. They absorb stormwater, which is an issue that cities are facing. Neighborhoods that have trees actually have higher real estate value, and that's good for homeowners. It's good for cities because they can get higher taxes from it. And there's an interesting study cited in my book from London that says that neighborhoods with trees have better, lower mental health issue incidence. So you get all those benefits out of planting trees, and they're beautiful too. So we need to continually, so I described we need to do scenario planning. We need to be finding the inflection points that have the most co-benefits and investing in those. So we can take these systems now and begin to integrate them. This is about a microgrid. So we can be taking, if we have green buildings that are generating electricity and that are actually cleansing their water, we can be taking those and connecting those together into microgrids. And these are twice as energy efficient as the current electric grid system we use, where they integrate solar and batteries and biogas. We can be actually turning our sewage into, as we digest it, into power, etc. We can be doing the same thing with heat. We can be doing the same thing with water and integrating those all into much more efficient and much more local and responsive systems. That's the physical technical system. We need to weave in that a green nature system. Now, this is from Singapore. We've actually learned that as we build taller buildings, we can actually compensate for that. Taller buildings and higher density and mixed use and mixed income allow us to have more and better mass transit, which gets more cars off the street. Singapore is actually reducing its number of roads and dedicating that space back to nature. And they're not just doing parks, they're doing parks with indigenous biodiversity. So you have to think of there's a second system to the technical system we weave through our cities, which is the natural system. And then there's the third system, which is the social system. So I told you earlier one of the goals is to equalize the landscape of opportunity. And we now know that these are the factors that actually do it. It starts in the bottom with affordable housing. When families spend 30% of their income on housing, it turns out in low-income families and working-class families, their health and education outcomes are much better than when they're spending more than 50% of their income on housing. In addition, we know that how important health is to function. By the way, just an interesting thing that there's a test now that's just beginning to be used that's connecting health and education. And in America, we've discovered that 20% of low-income children fail in school because they can't see the blackboard. They just need glasses. Another 20% of the kids have had early ear infections and don't hear well. And with a weak course of antibiotics, that can be cured, and they do better in class. So healthcare and education, all these need to be superb. In the 1970s, Finland had an okay education system. Not great, but they said, we're going to create the greatest one in the world. And today, Finland has the best education outcomes of any nation in the world. Any city can do this. Any nation can do this if it sets its mind to it. So on that base of housing, health, and education, then we know how important open space, community gardens, fresh and healthy food are. We know how important on the other side, the community and social services, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Walkability and transit, which I have just alluded to, jobs, and then arts and culture. And one of the reasons arts and culture is so important is the very beginning of civilization began with our capacity for symbolic thought. And that is what gave rise to language. That is what gave rise to human cooperation at an expanded level in what E.O. Wilson calls the social conquest of the earth. In 1997 in Chicago, there was a great heat wave, and about 700 people died. A demographer named Eric Kleinenberg mapped that. And what he observed was that in the wealthy white neighborhoods, the death rates were low. In the poor black neighborhoods, the death rates were higher. But there were two very poor black neighborhoods in which the death rates were lower than in the white neighborhoods. And the reason why was that it had very beautiful social networks, networks of compassion and care, where people reached out and act. And these networks preceded the heat wave. They created the resilience for it. My first real connection with the RSA was through the Social Brain Project. And the Social Brain Project and other work that was related to it was really about how do we, through social relations, create community resilience. It's very, very important work. So I'm going to end with one last thing, which is a disease which I believe is attacking all this. So we need very healthy social systems if we're going to achieve all the other things. It's kind of the foundational base of human beings. There's something called adverse childhood experiences, and is a disease that is taking over the world. When a child experiences between the age of 0 and 4 experiences abuse, family dysfunction, or neglect, and this can be, you know, parental, you know, like domestic violence, or a father being called or hauled off to jail, or physical abuse or neglect, each one of those is called an adverse childhood experience. If a child has 4 or more, we now know from vast statistical studies that it creates both physical health issues and mental health issues for the rest of their life. Physically, now, this is, you'll see 1 ACEs, 2, 3, 4, and believe me, a lot of children have more than that. They are more than twice as likely to have arthritis, asthma, cancer, diabetes, heart attack, kidney disease, stroke, etc. These are, in America, what we think of as the diseases of poverty. They're really the diseases of abuse, and the initial study was actually done in a white suburban population outside of San Diego, so this is a phenomenon all across our nation, and I believe many, many other nations. When a child suffers from adverse childhood, so just more on the health, a person who has 6 or more ACEs is statistically likely to live 20 years less. And we're seeing, by the way, in the United States, a decline in lifespan in middle-aged white males from suicide. And that may be tied back to this, too. Has an enormous economic cost. The Center for Disease Control says for every cohort of 4-year-olds, the lifelong cost of their impact on social services, et cetera, is $124 billion for every 4-year-old this year, next year, That cohort of a four-year-old is $124 billion. Now, one of the neurological phenomena of this is that when a child's impacted by ACEs, they move into their brain is looking for threat, and it becomes permanently wired in the flight-fight mode. And what that means is before puberty, they do very poorly in school because they're always looking around. They can't pay attention because of the threat. And I told you how important social networks are. They can't form strong social networks because they are feared of human relations. And after puberty, they go into the fight mode. They do form, they join gangs, high-risk behavior, seven times more likely to have teenage pregnancy, et cetera. So this is an invisible disease that actually is corroding the base of our ability to have a coherent society. All the things that I began to describe, that we need to actually equalize the landscape of opportunity, the enormous technical, social, economic challenges ahead of us cannot be solved by a population that is increasingly traumatized. So this is an area that we really seriously have to focus on. We know, by the way, there are a series of solutions. Meditation is one, that a trauma doesn't actually lock in the brain for the first 90 days. We're beginning to see much more what's called trauma-informed care. And I want to end with this. We need actually a transformation in the national consciousness and the global consciousness if we're going to be able to solve these problems, if we're going to really build communities of opportunity. In the 1960s, we saw this happen in the United States, that we moved from being a nation in which racism was an accepted practice to one in which it wasn't. It does not mean that civil rights are perfect in the United States or that we have reached equality of civil rights. But we put it on the table that that was our national goal, that many stood together and said, this is what matters for me. We actually said that compassion, that we need to be a more compassionate society. And to me, in the end, we know, actually in my book I described, we actually know all the technical solutions we need to solve the problems before us. What we need is the will to make it so, and that calls upon us to be to call on our best nature. The architect Christopher Alexander said, making wholeness heals the maker. Our job, I believe, in the world is to make wholeness, and in doing so, we heal ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was every bit as lyrical as the book, and the book's a sort of concerto to humanity in cities. And the themes you draw on are enormous, and the city is a lens through which we view them. And listening to you talk, I couldn't help reflect on a talk we had here a few months ago with Yuval Noah Harari, and the author of Sapiens and Homo Deus, who covers a lot of the same ground as you in many respects in his history of humanity, but ultimately comes to a very pessimistic conclusion. And the conclusion is that ultimately humanity's inequalities will widen, it will ultimately be superseded. When that happens, we don't know. You come to a more hopeful and optimistic conclusion. And I want to go back to the sort of beginning of your talk where you described this economic system that is creating these inequalities, environmental degradation, so on and so forth. You didn't talk much about the political system per se. And it would just be interesting to get your thoughts on why you would have faith in the political system to regenerate itself in a way that can produce the sort of responses that you're talking about.
I actually don't see that in the current political situation, but I want to address one thing just very briefly before. So a couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of meeting and talking with E.O. Wilson, who's the guy who wrote the book, The Social Conquest of the Earth. And what he says is that, our evolutionary competitiveness comes not from individual competitiveness, but from group competitiveness, and group competitiveness comes from group altruism. So it is only our. So the challenge is, and this is the political challenge, we live in a world now that's very much us against them. If he says that if we can expand our sense of group altruism to the whole world, much larger, ultimately to the whole world, then we have the capacity to solve this issue. There's a very interesting author, Rebecca Solnit, who wrote a book called Paradise Built in Hell. And she describes how every time there's a disaster, so for example, you see enormous good well-being, you know, goodness arise. In New York City, when 9/11 happened, it was a terrible thing, but there was love in the streets. Everybody was helping everybody. The crime disappeared. This enormous sense of we're all in it together and we're going to help each other survive, thrived. Now, our political system is in general designed to go against this. Interestingly, the place, and this is why I focus on cities, the place where we see the best is in cities. Because mayors and city councils have to deliver every day. In the United States, we have a huge amount of national posturing between Democrats and Republicans, an enormous amount of stagnation and very little good happening. But in cities, whether they're run by Democratic or Republican mayors, we're seeing actually them actively trying to solve all these issues. I actually don't think they've reached a level that's sufficient yet to solve them. But so and this does not mean we need to devolve back into city states, mm-hmm. but is hopefully the politics of integration and collaboration and effort to do well for all, that we can incubate that in cities and then rise it to states and nations.
Interesting, okay. There is a tension, I think it came through in your talk, and it comes through in the book, between the systemic technical solutions, right. and you ended your talk by saying that we know the technical solutions and the VUCA style right. problems, you know, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, right. ambiguity, which are about people, where we don't necessarily even know some of the questions, let alone some of the solutions. Does that tension worry you in our ability to come together into the sort of compassionate city that you outline? And when I was reading the book, I was thinking about Songdo City in right. Korea, which is this sort of, for those of you who don't know, is a sort of idyllic city that's kind of been built as a satellite of Seoul. You know, it has this amazing waste collection system, a smart city technology, science parks. It's kind of the city of the future. But it looks pretty dystopian to me right. when I watch the videos of it. And do you see that's a sort of tension that when planners and systematic thinking can take over and override people in place, that this tension emerges?
So first of all, I'm not saying that the chance that we're going to get through this is high.
Okay. So you're a pessimist like...
No. But I believe that we will only get through it if we have a vision of where we want to go. And that if we're all pessimistic, you know, what you put in the world is what you get back. If we're all pessimistic, we're going to get a lousy future. If we can actually imagine a much, much better future, that's the first step in knowing where we want to go. And remember I said to you, you know, I cut it a little short, but we should imagine a magnificent future. And then I had those community health indicators and then measure. So everybody's continually reminded, you know, we're 28% towards our education goal. We're 46% towards our health and well-being goal. You know, like, so we can, but we know where we're going. Today, the problem with the VUCA world, we are in this very volatile, uncertain, complex world. But we ourselves are volatile and uncertain and complex. We need to have this sense of purpose, this sense of what we want to achieve. It'll help us a whole lot.
And where have cities taken the people along with them on a journey? Because, you know, health and well-being, right. I mean, they're prime indicators. They right. depend on human behavior as right. much as the system, the public health right. systems you have in place. Right. Where has that journey right. been taken, and where can we draw inspiration from? Got it.
So I'm going to talk about Singapore, but just to comment on Songdo. So the reality is many more of our cities are going to be that urban sprawl that I showed you in Lagos. So, you know, that's really the future. It's being built now. There are a few technically perfect cities. Nothing's perfect, but technically advanced cities like Songdo. But those aren't, that's a low percentage of where human beings are going to live in the next decades. Maybe 100 years from now they'll live like that. But so Singapore, what's amazing about Singapore... So I was in Singapore in 1979, and you know, it was a messy, polluted, dirty, diseased city with homeless people, and people living on houseboats and defecating in the bay and all that. And today, it's, you know, there's not a single homeless person. Everybody's employed, the fantastic education or retired or whatever, incredible education system, fantastically integrated series of goals. And by the way, they have a pension system that both takes care of your health care, makes care of your retirement. When you're young, the pension system lends you money and lets you buy an apartment. When you reach 65, they buy the apartment back from you, give you all the money that it was appreciated value, so have a bunch of money. I mean, they've got all the pieces really worked out. It's kind of a dictatorship. And so what was amazing, so we're in that case, they were very lucky. It was a benign dictatorship, which, by the way, said one of the things we're going to solve, which is prevalent in Asia, is zero corruption. Like, I think if they, you know, you're corrupt, they cut off your hand or something there. But there is zero. So it really works. Now they have to make the transition, which they're beginning to make, to democracy and to the kind of more messy liberalization that so many of us enjoy. Yeah. The question is, can we have that freedom and yet achieve the really amazing achievements that they've done in Singapore?
Well, let me make the case for a non-dictatorship approach.
I'm not a big fan of dictatorship.
No, I said. But in the book as well, you draw on the research from Sean Stafford. I hadn't come across it before. This is the Allentown and Youngstown example.
Right.
Allentown had a diverse approach to putting together its city plans in the 1960s, drew on a greater variety of perspectives. Youngstown was kind of the country club mentality, is how you would describe it. Allentown, because it had a diverse approach, has prospered since. Youngstown has not. Allentown has a higher median income, an overall income, and so on. So it seemed to me in there was some hope that the necessity to conduct some sort of public, diverse, civic dialogue around places does reap quantifiable rewards. And maybe in that example, there's some hope for the civic relationship with the future.
Well, what's interesting, I'm a big fan of community-based planning, and one of the slides I passed very quickly through and didn't talk to you about was a community-based planning slide. So I deeply believe in that. But what was interesting actually about that case, it was one of leadership. So in Youngstown, the leadership was all this, you know, old white people who joined, who were members of the Garden Club, but they were on all the same boards, they all used the same bank and all that. And in the 1950s, studies were shown in both Allentown and Youngstown that said the steel industry is going away. You were dependent upon the steel industry. Figure something else out. And in Youngstown, they were all so interconnected, everything's going so well, and they're all so rich and wealthy, the leaders, that they just didn't respond to the future. In Allentown, they had a much more diverse leadership structure. So it wasn't about a bottom-up. It was the top level was much more diverse, and they were the ones who chose to be much more proactive. So I just want to give
I wonder if we can extend it to a wider civic diversity engagement as well.
So we totally need a wider civic engagement and diversity. And I'm seeing in most of the places where I work, enormous civic engagement, but it's not being harnessed in a productive way. So I want to give you one other example from the book. In 1950, Birmingham, Alabama, and Atlanta, Georgia, had exactly the same population within 1,000 people and the same median income within $1,000. Birmingham, Alabama became the symbol of American racism. There was some horrific events that happened there in terms of integration. When those happened, the press called the mayor of Atlanta and said, "What do you think of this?" And he said, "We're too busy growing to hate." And Atlanta created this whole other cultural meme that came from the leadership at the top, which is that we're just, you know, like we're all going to prosper. We want prosperity for all of us. And today, Atlanta is literally 6 times larger, has literally twice the median income of Birmingham, Alabama. And it's a direct outgrowth. And that's partly, of course, that had to be supported by the citizens below. But the signal of who we are and where we're going came from leadership at the top.
Okay, I'm going to open it out to the audience, and I'm going to take questions in rounds of 3. So go for it.
Hi, I work in a school, and I'm interested to know how do you teach the younger generation to cope with VUCA?
Hi, I'm Jonathan Rowson. You spoke about vision, and you clearly have a vision of your own. You've written a visionary book. The RSA also has a vision. I'd like to think I have one. I know that Donald Trump may have been elected on one. Steve Bannon seems to have one. The vision is abundant. There's no lack of vision. I wanted to ask you what your theory of vision is and what makes one vision trump another.
Coin a phrase. And this gentleman here.
Hi, I'm a pensioner, 63. At around 50, I cut my work hours, and I spent about 10 hours a week in serious physical activity. So my state of fitness right now is about that of the weekend footballer, and it's improving. But my point, I see no reason when I'm 90, I should not be as fit. And I wonder if that's a consideration as to the work-life balance for longevity. How society will have to, what shall I say, bring in that change if people want to be fit at 90, at 100.
Okay, so first, on the transformation of education. So my wife, who is here, and I, 15 years ago, created something called the Garrison Institute, and it created a program called CARE, Cultivating Awareness and Resilience in Education, which is bringing meditation and other techniques to actually help teachers be much more resilient in this VUCA age. And what we have found is if the teacher is much more resilient then and compassionate, their ability to be to function better in school makes a difference. That program is now part of a larger program that comes out of University of Virginia called the Compassionate Schools Program, which is being used now by the city of Louisville, Kentucky, and others. So you may want to Google Compassionate Schools Program and CARE at the Garrison Institute, and those, I think, will be really useful resources. So Jonathan's question about vision. So we live in a world of competing visions. And again, my sense is at the national level, it's extremely hard to reconcile these. But at the city level, I am seeing... So for example, Louisville not only has this Compassionate Schools Program, but the reason why is because they have signed on to the Compassionate City Program. And they've said, this is our overarching vision, to be a compassionate city. And when you frame it that way, then all these other competing visions, if you, that's where it takes a city with vision, a city with leadership. It then begins to integrate all these different ones, and there continually be everything that happens there is in itself, but challenged to be framed as a compassionate city. And the last question is, absolutely, fitness is one important aspect of whole systems. And one of the things we've learned is the more parks and open space we weave into cities, the more that people can walk, the more they naturally turn towards fitness.
Okay, great.
My name is Ian from Project Donkey Engine. Do you have any experience or can you give us any examples of taking, monetizing and measuring money saved in health outcomes that are enabled by your various projects and putting them back into providing, for instance, cheap housing?
Fantastic. I love all your questions. I love that question. So our company worked with a not-for-profit in White Plains, New York, an hour north of New York City, built housing for women who are over 50, who were formerly homeless or very low-income wage workers, who have mental or physical health disabilities. These women were experiencing 11 hospital emergency room visits a week. The project implemented something called telemedicine, where once a week, college interns measure for the women their blood pressure, blood oxygen level, and their pulse. That goes to Pace University Medical Center, where it's analyzed. What comes back are recommendations on diet and exercise. They went from 11 emergency room visits a month to 2. That saved the medical system $500,000 a year. So we know, and I can give you many, many other examples. Another one is all our buildings are very green. We use non-toxic and low VOC material, and we are now measuring the reduction. This work still has, the work's not complete, but we have a lot of self-reports of dramatic reduction in asthma, particularly in children, and hospital visitations. So now the question is, how do we monetize and bring this back into affordable housing? One of the things about the American CARE Act, which is what's called Obamacare, is it allows states to experiment. And New York State is actually looking at how do you take these savings and use it to fund more affordable and supportive housing. And so it's really essential that our company is actually doing a massive study across tens of thousands of units of affordable housing over a 10-year life to actually try and measure all these health savings, prove the economic costs, and make the case for this recycling of dollars that you so wisely call for.
I want to come back on the inequality question, actually, because I think, what was the level you said was the social unrest level, 0.4?
It's a Gini of 4, a 0.4, and a lot of us are there.
Yeah, well, London is at 0.44, because I looked it up, so it probably explains some of the issues that we've been facing. But what I'm wondering is that at a city level, I can see, you know, some of the cities you mentioned in the book, like Copenhagen, Stockholm, and so on, they're part of more equal societies with particular models of welfare state. What can be done at the city level, do you think, to confront growing inequality? What are the strategies you can deploy there?
So we need dozens of them. But for example, during my book tour, I visit a lot of cities. When I was in Los Angeles, the people, not because of me, but the people voted for a $1.2 billion bond issue to fund 10,000 units of homeless housing. When I was in Denver, the people voted for a tax increase to fund affordable housing. So what we're seeing is, so these are, by the way, the Denver metro region actually also approved another tax increase that funded a vast mass transit system that connected lower-income communities with job centers. Cities could use state and federal support for all these things. We're seeing cities across America raising the minimum wage from $7 an hour to $15 an hour. That's doubling the minimum wage. We're seeing cities. So what's great about cities is that they are incubators, and they can all try different things. And we're seeing many more networks where cities are sharing best practices.
Thank you. Well, sadly, we've come to the end of time, so I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
You're
John
welcome.
Rose. I should say the book is available. I'd highly recommend it. Very strongly recommend it. Thank you for your thoughts, Jonathan. Thank you for your questions. And finally, just let's give a round of applause to Jonathan F.P. Rose.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.